Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in East Asian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. My name is Roman Paschka, and I'm a host on the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Dean Brink, who is Associate Professor at the National Jiao Tung University in Taiwan, and is also the author of a book titled Japanese Poetry and Its Publics, From Colonial Taiwan to Fukushima, which was published by Routledge in 2018. Hello, Dean, and welcome.
Well, thank you for interviewing me.
To start the interview, could you tell us a little bit about yourself? How did you become involved in this field?
Well, I've gone back and forth between comparative literature and Japanese studies, and I love literature in general. I dabble in writing poetry and science fiction stories, but I also, since undergraduate, I've taken many courses in philosophy, and as a graduate student, I basically majored in philosophy, but I keep going back and forth between poetry and philosophy, and so poetry won out for a while, and another thing I can tell you is I began as a student of politics, but it was during the Cold War. And so what I realized was the department, the Henry something Jackson Department of International Studies and Politics at the University of Washington, where I started as an undergrad, taught fiction rather than politics. It was basically the one side of the story. There was the American side. And it seemed to me that if it's political science, it should be more scientific, more objective. And so I ended up in the English department. But I never lost my political spirit and interest in politics and social justice issues, which really has guided me to this work on Taiwan, also known as the Orphan of Asia. And
Okay. So if you could tell us a little bit more about the book project. How did you come up with this idea for the book? It's about poetry, but it's also about politics. So is it literary theory, or is it, by the way, the book is published by Routledge in a series which is called Postcolonial Politics, so it seems to be included in this category rather than literary theory, and I was curious to know how, why is the book in this series?
Because the editor liked the idea for the book, and Taiwan is a very interesting post-colonial object of study, and there hasn't been a lot done on it. And for me, what I discovered was that when you're in Japan or working on Japanese materials within a so-called Japanese system or tradition or whatever you want to call it, the intertextuality becomes very full, but full in the sense of an echo chamber. When you get to Taiwan, And you realize that the uses of poetry are for specific purposes, and that there is no echo chamber within Taiwan, except for that imported in very specific zones of relevance, both with respect to Japan and Taiwan, it becomes really interesting. And that's basically, that's why I went to Taiwan. I was there going through the library, and I realized there's a lot of interesting materials in the newspapers on the microfiche at the Taiwan University Library. And so I decided to move there, and I found academic jobs right away, and I end up where I am now after about 8 years of bouncing around and experiencing different parts of Taiwan. And should I stop there?
So it all started with poetry for you, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
And to move on to the book, the discussion about the book. So in the introduction, you say that you actually examine how modern Japanese poetry has remained central to public life, not only in Japan, but also in its former colony of Taiwan. And I quote, so you talk about, I quote, uses of poetry shown not only to support colonialism and imperialism, emerging objectionable forms of exploitation, as well as the destruction of ecologies, but also to present a medium of resistance, a minor literature for registering protest, forming transnational affiliations, and promoting grassroots democracy. So poetry seems to have all these different uses, right? And if you could tell us a little bit more about the structure of the book and...
Sure. Exactly. And that's really what ties the book together. It takes this question of how poetry has various public uses. Most of the examples I take are from newspapers. My gamble is that the type of intertextuality that we experience in Western poetry needs to be rethought in Japanese poetry. And within Japanese studies, there's already in Japanese literary studies there's already a language of for situating the rhetorical devices, the poetic devices that are in play. But how to make these relevant to politics has yet to be established. And so by taking these different figures within haiku and senryu, I was able to map how in haiku there's a very highly codified matrices of association, and in the season words, the kigo, but also inherited from waka in the engo, the associated words, and how basically every word that appears in the classical anthologies, the imperial anthologies, are fair game in strictly speaking in waka for many generations. Now waka and tanka have opened up, of course, and haiku has opened up, and senryu has always been opened up a lot to ordinary language. And so in trying to map these typologies, these intertextual typologies, the typological intertextuality based on categories and associations and so forth, there still is a question of how does this relate to specific ontological situations. And so in Japan, tanka sometimes is taken serious in a political way, and sometimes it's not. It's just taken as a practice, an art, and anyone who is political is engaging in a vulgar vulgarized form of tanka. And then you have a question of what to do with poets like Tawaramachi, who is both very artistic and also, in her own way, both putting aside questions of self-promotion and so forth, but also political in her own way. She can be political. And it's from reading Tawaramachi many years ago that I began to see this structure of commercialized poetry, public poetry, being also very having these political implications and so forth. But so the introduction to this current book speaks to ways of mapping, making poetry relevant. And I use Badiou, his idea of poetic configurations as a what he calls a truth condition, where you grab a certain linguistic construct, a poem, and you treat it as something that implicates worlds, to put it very simply. There's all sorts of distinction making and so forth, but it forms a. This is I'm developing this for in the future work to clarify this more, but the book as the structure of the book is it opens with a chapter. Exploring how the settlers, the Japanese settlers in Taiwan, use poetry at different steps in the first 20, 30 years to promote a Japanese consciousness, positive acceptance of Japanese rule, and acceptance of the names used for mountains even were codified in songs. And so this becomes a way of mapping very clear. I think the first chapter is the most important chapter. It's a way of mapping how, in a colony, the Japanese couldn't rely on a already understood associations and uses, but had to establish the possibility for using Japanese poetry in non-Japanese lands. I start with quoting only, the first chapter quotes mostly Japanese authors writing about poetry, and the second chapter focuses solely, or mostly, sometimes it's hard to tell by just the names, they're not always famous poets, they're just people who send in their poems in the newspapers, but it's mostly Taiwanese writers in chapter two. So it focuses on the transculturation and typological intertextuality from the point of view of Taiwanese. Questions of, common questions of mimicry and these sort of things. And then chapter three treats poetry during the war by someone who died in Taiwan, but I never mentioned that in the book. And I don't want to get into Taiwanese politics, but one critic said, "What, you don't even mention that Yamakawa Hiroshi died in a bomb raid in Taiwan?" Because that would have, in my mind, it's interesting as a fact, but it doesn't add anything to the fact that he wrote all these nationalist poems that are very interesting in the legacy of in the line of the nativist writers that go back to Kamono Mabuchi and so forth. And so I was happy to work in some nativist connections through and Taiwanese connections in this, one of the first articles I published that made up some of the chapters in this book. This is one of the earliest works, so it doesn't fit in as smoothly. The first two, nice continuity, and then jumping to the last chapters 4, 5, and 6, these are post-war, contemporary, in fact, and treating from the late 1960s to the present.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. So even if there's something that you didn't write about in the book. You can talk about it during the interview. So if there are other things that you didn't mention in the book but you want to talk about during the interview, feel free to do that. Now, actually, I have a question about the chapter where you discuss Fukushima, the nuclear disaster at Fukushima. And in the last part of the chapter, when you write the conclusions, you write, and I quote again, "Yet the most surprising revelation in this study has been how the colonial hyperobject and 311 or nuclear hyperobject create complex post-colonial possibilities for long-distance entanglement that do not relinquish authority to former colonizer or colonized, but acknowledge larger forces that allow a sort of equalization and resolution of past injustices, a new appreciation of residual commonality born of the colonial apparatus, but shaped by recent disaster." And my question was, what are these larger forces that you mentioned? And also, I think related to this, in the same paragraph at the end, at the very end of the paragraph, you mentioned a new ethical positioning. And I was wondering if you could give us more details about this ethical positioning.
Sure. I left that open for two reasons. One is there's no room. The publisher didn't give me that many pages to go on and talk about post-humanism, but also because of Taiwanese politics today is so complicated. As you may know, everyone may know, Taiwan is right now there's a lot of pressure from China to return to that fold, if there ever was any fold to return to, since Taiwan has been a colony for so long and independent for so long. And anyway, that's as longish. I don't want to open that can of worms. But the ethical, if you want to put it in very positive terms, I would say there are earthquakes in Japan all the time. There are earthquakes in Taiwan all the time. There are big earthquakes in both Japan and Taiwan all the time. And we always are the biggest donors to each other. I mean, we always help each other. And chapter 4 and chapter 5 are about the Taiwan Kadan, the Taiwan Tonka Association. And I joined the association writing Tonka with these elderly Taiwanese and a few younger Japanese as well. And these are the people I learned about this from. And these poems are not published in newspaper. There is a local Japanese newspaper that it's published in, but they don't get the exposure of the old newspapers in the colonial period. These are published in an in-house journal and on a website occasionally. And sometimes in Japan, too, there'll be exchanges and so forth. But it's more of a Japan Friendship Association as well as a poetry association. There's a lot of very political poetry written. Not all of the members, but a lot are aware of the political situation and how we in Taiwan, I'm a Taiwanese citizen now, how we depend on the goodwill of Japanese support, American support, and support from everyone around the world to maintain our democracy. That's the one problem. We have a difference of opinion with China over democracy. And so ethical positioning, yeah, the openness, the hyperobject, it's the term from Timothy Morton. The idea is that there's something, I disagree with the use of the term, by the way, is that something that you cannot understand, something so big that we cannot grasp it. I think everything can be grasped in parts, and there's nothing we grasp in whole. If you get down to the level of an atom, we cannot grasp an atom. The more we know, the more it slips away. And so I think the idea of the hyperobject is an excuse to put us into a sort of humble positioning vis-a-vis some hyperobject. But so it's a cop-out, in effect. And rather than a cop-out, to see that we have to choose what we care about rather than being too passive about things, I think is the right direction for opening up new ethical possibilities vis-a-vis all sorts of interaction, complex interactions in politics and weather, energy, climate change, and go on and on.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And is poetry one of the ways in which we can grasp this this hyperobject?
Yes, that's what I love about Japanese poetry. It has an established form that's very easy to understand in haiku and senryu and tanka, and these various figures of speech, of rhetorical figures that are present within it, that have been reified in interesting ways in contemporary poetry, and that is published on a daily basis in Japanese newspapers. This is, poetry is very powerful. It's able to bring a clear, biting critiques to issues that remain ambiguous. It functions very much like the political cartoons. And once you see a political cartoon, you can see things more clearly about a certain issue. It may be exaggerated. The scenario is certainly exaggerated, but it opens up channels of thought and congealed in very interesting, compressed ways that you can get a handle on immediately. This is the power, I believe, of poetry.
Okay, thank you. What I find absolutely fascinating about the book is the fact that you don't discuss Japanese poetry, only Japanese poetry written by Japanese poets, but you also look at Taiwanese poets. And to my knowledge, this is something that has not really been done, right?
That's right.
There's not a lot of research about Taiwanese poets writing Japanese poetry, whether it's in during the colonial period or recently.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, because there was even a book of translations of colonial era tanka from Japanese into Chinese recently. It was the product of a cooperation between a Taiwanese and a Japanese, and even they excluded any poetry by Taiwanese, even though there were just extremely famous, very gifted poets, and they were just naturally excluded because they weren't Japanese. This, unfortunately, replicates a stereotype, and it goes way back to the war and seeing the Kotodama is only endowed in a sort of racial way, very odd.
Also, the stereotype that only Japanese people can write Japanese poetry.
Right, or even speak Japanese.
Okay. Also, in the introduction, I just remembered you mentioned a documentary movie that is somehow connected with the book, writing the book. If you could tell us a little bit more about that documentary movie that you actually made in Taiwan, right?
That's right. Yeah, that it was a 3-year project, and so it took me 3 years to get into the group because the group was not really happy to see me. Because remember, it's a Japanese Friendship Association, and they were a little bit regu no kanjina, a little bit cold at first, but then they became very warm, and now I'm part of the group and like a permanent member, sort of permanent fixture. Although I don't always go because of children, the book is called the what is it? What did I call it? The Rising Sun.
The documentary, Horizons of the Rising Sun,
oh, yeah.
Post-Colonial Nostalgia and Politics in the Taiwan Tanka Association Today.
Yeah.
So it's actually a documentary about that association and about you becoming a member of...
Well, I didn't include that.
No, okay.
No, I mentioned that in one paragraph in the book, but in the documentary, it has mostly entirely new information in the documentary. And it's personal interviews, and I asked political questions. I have very pointed questions. You know, basically, what do you feel about the period? It's called the period of Japanese rule. You might think, well, they were occupiers. But it's very, for political reasons, the descriptive term, period of Japanese rule, is preferred by most scholars. So I asked them about their experiences, and I got a whole wide range of experience. People that were, you know, talked about discrimination. Most didn't talk about it, or very, very just in passing, but it definitely was there, of course. You can't have a colony without discrimination. And then I asked about how they felt about the retrocession of the return of Taiwan to China, you opened a whole bag of worms, and people, their politics came to the fore. The former leader, especially talked about how it was never, you know, Taiwan deciding, like Okinawa decided to be part of Japan. Taiwan never got to decide what to be part of. And since when they were during the Qing Dynasty, actually only half of the island was controlled by the Qing Dynasty. The other half was controlled by Yanjumi, the Aboriginal, indigenous peoples. So it's very complicated in many different levels. And I also asked them about their feeling today about Japan or Taiwan. Oh yeah, and it was during the Sunflower Movement. So I asked them about the Sunflower Movement in some of the interviews.
So the research and the field work that you did for the documentary, that was actually in conjunction with some parts of the book, right?
Yes, it was the, they're actually, the Japanese government supported the research, not the Japanese, the Taiwanese government supported through the ministry, what's now called the Ministry of Science and Technology, the research on the political poetry during the colonial period, and then the contemporary poetry group, and they furnished the, made it possible for me to make the film.
Okay. Who is the book for? Is it for people who are interested in Japanese poetry? Is it for people in media studies?
I think if I could give it to students in certain classes, it'd be in Asian study classes, in Japanese literature classes, the Japanese studies classes. I developed a sort of fresh approach to Japanese poetry, and I hope everyone who's interested in Japanese poetry will take the time to read it, and whether they agree with it or not, and just see if it makes sense or to them. And yeah, if you hate it, it's fine.
Okay, so it's not just for people who are interested in Japanese poetry, but also for other categories or professions, or even people in poetics, right?
Well, might be interested certainly. Cultural historians or those who like to teach, I think those, anyone teaching Japanese history or East Asian history who likes to use examples from literature would find a goldmine of examples in this book. Yeah.
And if there's one thing that you would like your readers to take away from the book, what would that be? What would be like the most, not important, but...
Well, just that that Japanese poetry is very interesting, and it's not about nature. There's nothing natural about Japanese poetry. Everything natural is conventional. Okay? Anyone who writes Japanese poetry seriously, in Japanese at least, will have to know the way you're supposed to express yourself in certain situations. And it's not based on experiencing nature and some sort of moment of insight. That may be involved, but you have to translate that moment using conventional phrases. So there's a lot of pastiche involved, and that pastiche gets substituted in interesting ways in Senryu especially, but in any modern, more of the more freestyled modern traditional form poetry. I'm not talking about free poetry, free verse in Japanese, but you'll have a lot of substitutions of this pattern of association with current events that make it political and interesting. And my research is all about exploring this as what makes Japanese poetry important and relevant today, not because it speaks to some universal essentialist nature, blah, blah, blah. Not interested in that.
Okay. And as somebody who lives in Japan and is worried about Fukushima and the consequences of the nuclear disaster, my question would be, what can Japanese poetry teach us about how to deal with such a nuclear disaster? How to deal, for example, not only with a disaster, but with its consequences, with the tragic consequences of the tsunami in 2011. What do we find in Japanese poetry? How can it help us?
That's a great question. You know, the other day, if I may be personal, my daughter was by me, and I was watching something about the Fukushima disaster, and I was crying. I couldn't stop crying, and she had never seen me cry. And I said, "If you don't cry when you see this, you're not human." And then later in the day, there was I don't watch TV, but it just happened to, I was absorbed by this depressing disaster. That day was also I saw an episode of the Chernobyl HBO series, which has this as its very theme. That's why I can't help but mention. This is how media studies all come together with these big issues. So the theme of the Chernobyl was, if you try to cover up the truth, it was about testing, it will lead to disaster. And I in my study of Senryu, dealing with, and also Tanka, dealing with the Fukushima disaster, what I found was that, like I mentioned before, in a way that parallels the use of what do you call those, political cartoons in newspapers that appear on a daily basis, but usually only one or two per day. In Japanese newspapers, you have between 8 and 10 or 12 Senryu in different newspapers appearing every day. And they all won't live up to that intensity, but a lot of them will. And they'll pick apart the different news in the way that you can say forces us to face truths that have been derealized. And in Fukushima, I think what was derealized, it was that this was a disaster in the making. It was, there were all these different warnings made, and the company decided that it's better to save money. And this is the same thing that the Soviet Union did in the Chernobyl disaster in a more roundabout way. So yes, poetry can remind us of this matters, and I don't know if it will change people, but I think it has a nudging effect on society, I would call it.
And it helps us deal with the suffering and cope with reality, right?
Yes, on that level too. I'm thinking more in terms of old politics. But yeah, poetry, that's more tanka.
Okay.
The senryu is more peeping, criticism. And tanka, you can get into more emotional.
Okay. We're running out of time. We're approaching the end of the interview. But before we finish, I have another question for you. What are you working on right now? What are your future projects? If you could tell us a few things about that.
Oh yes. Well, as I mentioned, I like swing between philosophy and poetry. So I have one book forthcoming. It's an introduction, shorter introduction to Nishida Kitaro, Tanami Hajime, Tosaka Jun, in terms of their writings in the philosophy of science, dealing basically with quantum mechanics and relativity and so forth. I'm translating huge sections from all of these, and there's so much material, and it's been rendered invisible, it seems, by the emphasis on their more religious spiritual writings and so forth. But I think it will add a dimension that will make those also more interesting, hopefully, too. And then I'm also working on finishing a work on poetry that develops this Baduyan approach that began in Japanese poetry, but I'm using it to read poets as diverse as Amir Baraka, of course, the poet, African-American poet, well-known for his Somebody Blew Up America poem that causes a lot of controversy. And I'm trying to explain that controversy using this similar methodology. And also John Ashbery, who I have a complicated sort of literary relationship with, and I found the Japanese approach also to be helpful to politicize or situate politically his poems, which are notoriously flat in terms of taking no position and negating with his left hand what he writes with, blah, blah.
So you're working on a book on poetry and Japanese philosophy.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah, my two loves.
Okay. Thank you very much, Dean. Thank you for joining us today.
Well, thank you very much for interviewing me. It's very nice.
So this was our interview with Dean Brink, who is author of Japanese Poetry and Its Publics, From Colonial Taiwan to Fukushima. Everybody, thanks for listening to New Books in East Asian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. See you next time.